If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blah Blah Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grimeric Show. Coming at you this week with Jack Bialik. It's a good chat. It's a fun one. He's written a book on sort of like ancient stuff that we take for granted, or stuff the ancient people were doing, but not super ancient. They're like, not in Grimeric terms anyway, like mid-ancient, what we would consider the like history, not prehistory. It sounds like he's getting ready to dabble into the prehistory part of it as well, which is going to be interesting because he's going to find a bunch of crazy stuff that's going to blow his mind. And it sounds like he's already ready for it. So
I think it's also about time capsules. Like, there's modern time capsules happening and ways to stop to save your information. Like, I think he's looking at stuff like the digitization of our society right now and how fragile that is, that really if something happened like an EMP, that it's gone. Like, even the example I used was like 35-year-old 8mm tape. Like, it's really hard to digitize that right now. So how do we keep all these records that we want to keep?
Well, would you just have to watch it and film it with another camera?
Yeah, but even to watch it, you have to use a VCR that has the right RF frequency. It's a Sony proprietary.
Do you get a VCR?
Well, I mean, I'm gonna go to the thrift store in town here and see if they got one, but it's got to be a VCR with the RF thing on it too, right?
You have to have a VCR at the thrift store? Are you kidding me?
Oh, dude, I'm in the middle of Saskatchewan. There's a video store in town.
I bet you can buy one on Amazon.
There's a video store. Actually, I should just go to the video store. They'll have VCRs.
VHS to digital converter. With remote. Look at that.
This isn't VHS though, it's 8mm.
They do have a VCR you can buy here, a 4-head hi-fi VCR. How much do you think?
There are machines, rarer, I believe, that are made to put an 8mm in and digitize it.
But how much do you think this VCR costs?
Like a new or?
Seems to be new or like. Seems to be new, yeah.
$49.
Ha ha! $299. What's the kind you're looking for? 8mm?
Well, no, it's not going to have, they don't have them, right? It's not.
What is it called? The 8mm videotape player?
I guess, sure.
What do we got? VHS to digital converter, $259. I don't know if that's the same thing.
Well, London Drugs will do it for me for $40 or $50 per tape. And that it doesn't even, so if I give them an 8mm tape and there's nothing on it, I still have to pay $40 or $50.
Is that high eight?
High, I think so. It might be.
So you can buy this machine that says it'll converter capable with VHS, VCR, DVR, DVD, high eight, mini DV, camcorder, cassette tape, and gaming consoles. They'll convert it to digital.
Oh my God, that's the machine. Yeah, I think it's considered high eight. So what we're talking about, just for the listeners here, is like, but I've got these.
You need to find the machine to plug into this first.
Yeah, I've got them. Yeah, what do you mean?
So if you were gonna like if you wanted to take a VCR movie and rip it onto a digital MP4, you need a VCR.
Yeah, that's the converter then, that one, right?
That's the converter.
Yeah, digital converter, yeah. Yeah, we need that. I need that too, I think.
They need the player and the converter.
Yes. Unless I I use the TV. I think I can go VCR to TV, then to computer.
Wow.
But does that do it right in that thing so I don't need a computer then? Is that what you're saying? Does that do it right in there? Or does that...
Yeah, you would just plug the RCA cables right into this thing.
No, I know, but then does it go to a computer from there? Is that like a...
It has a little tiny screen on it.
Oh, yeah. So then what does it get digitized to? A little tiny disk or...
I guess it just gets turned into like a whatever file, and then you would just hook this thing up to your computer and copy the file onto it. And away you go.
How much is that?
$260. Do you have the Hi8 player?
I have the mini camcorder, and all the plastic has gotten greasy, like because
Probably hook the camcorder right up to this thing. And maybe do it like that.
I need to go.
Can you hook your camcorder up to your TV and watch the movies that way? Is it one of those
camcorders? No, it's got the proprietary RF cable antenna that it has to be. It's a Sony proprietary RF antenna.
And you can't get it on Amazon or eBay.
Well, I've been looking through. I've got our assistant helping me on it. And it was giving me all the options, right? There's a bunch of different options, but none of them are easy options. London Drugs for $40 might be the best option. But what I'm talking about is this 1990, 89 footage of like the Egypt pyramids traveling around Europe. There'll be some of that. There'll be some parties. Like there might be some scary shit on there too.
Did you make it sense?
I don't think I used it a lot. Like, you know, even though I had this little handy cam in the late 80s, I don't think I used it a lot.
Oh, it's going to be terrible. Did you make a sex tape?
No, I don't think so. No. There might have been part. Well, dude, we partied hard. I mean, we had the thing out when we were partying, so who knows what's on there.
Interesting. I don't think it's worth developing this.
I think it is. To see the Egypt in 1990, don't you want videos of Egypt in 1990?
I think the quality is going to be so terrible, it's going to be unwatchable.
No, come on.
I wonder what it would be like to even watch like a VCR movie, right? You know? Like,
yeah, that's true. I bet you it's worse than you think because you don't think of it as being bad back then, but now you watch it and you're like, wow.
No,
like,
even some shows you find, like you'll find you're watching, even on YouTube sometimes, you get like, if you find an older show that you rent or download that's from the like 90s, or the late 80s, it's like, and it hasn't been upgraded, you know? It's like, you can really notice how fuzzy and you can't even tell who's who. It's like, how did we even tell which characters are which when they're in the background?
Even when the TV doesn't have HD, high definition, like, the TV channels, some of them don't have HD, you really notice the difference.
Oh, yeah. What we were watching back in the day was terrible. It's just like fuzz.
But I still think it's worth the try anyways. But
we'll try one.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, the problem is it's expensive to try one, but it's expensive to do them all too. But I don't know. I think that what?
How many do you have?
Oh, like maybe six to eight tapes or something like that. Maybe nine.
Oh man. Yeah. So like $400 worth.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would try one and make sure it's worth it.
The problem is I don't know what's on them. Like they're not all like super accurately labeled. So
just gotta try one. The problem is because you might lose even more in the transition. You know, like you might do it and it might leave it literally unwatchable.
Well, it was telling you to actually warm it up first, like rewind it all the way, fast forward it all the way, then rewind it all the way back before you transfer it over.
That's gonna break when it gets to the end.
Maybe I should take a gamble at one that has some stuff on it and go there and see.
Try one.
Do one through London Drugs. Just take a chance at one I think because I must have labeled some of them. I'll go through the bundle and see.
Going through the bundle, I do want to give a shout out to Chucky. Uncle Chucky's probably listening. Of course, we met Chuck doing the trips. We're going to have him on the show because he's a geologist who made some interesting observations at the Azores that we want to talk to about. And he's been on a few trips with us now, so he's quite knowledgeable. But he came up for the weekend and came ice fishing. It was a good time.
Yeah, I was going to join you guys, but I ended up going to a lacrosse game. So
we didn't catch as much fish as we hoped, but at least we did.
You caught some big ones, didn't you?
Yeah, we caught a couple decent sized ones. I wouldn't call them big ones, but we probably caught 10 at least while he was here. Got out the one day, just the two of us, and then the next day with the family and had a time. It was a good time, good hanging out with Chuck. He's doing some work on the wife's ring, so that's all finished now as well. We had a few more diamonds to it. Finished that off.
So it's never good enough.
I think he's done well.
I'm not saying for sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was Chuck who wanted to add him. So
were you on those shacks on the frozen lake? Like, people were commenting in the chats about your truck being parked on the frozen lake and stuff.
That was mostly Tony. You know, funny enough, a truck went through the ice on that lake like a week before.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, but he was going out farther. So you got to watch, because people go there, and at the mouth of the bay, you know, you get a couple hundred people out ice fishing over a week or two, and they're drilling holes all over. You get two holes per, plus people move around a little bit. So you end up with hundreds and hundreds of holes drilled in the ice. And then we had the Chinook, right? So it was like above zero for a week and a half straight. And then you get the water on top of the ice that washes into all those holes, and it just keeps making them bigger and bigger. So that whole sort of chunk of ice ends up working against you. Because ideally what's supposed to happen is you drill the holes and they freeze overnight. And when you come back the next day, it's like they were never there.
Wow. But if you get the Chinook, then
get Chinooks. Yeah, like back home, this would never happen. And even up north would never happen. But with the Chinooks in Alberta, it's something you got to watch for. It's supposed to drop down below zero. So we were fishing in only like 6 or 7 feet of water. We got a camera. It's pretty neat to see. It was a fun experience. And you have the nice warm shack. But it's going to get cold for a while. And then probably in February, I think I'll go again. Because we just had the little slough shack, but you can get one there. I think it's like $350 for the night or something like that, or maybe $380. But it's like 20 feet by 12 feet, and it's got a queen-size bunk bed in it. So you in a 55-inch TV. So they hook up the generator for you. I could bring my Starlink, so we'll go out there on like a Saturday morning.
Bigger than a sea can. It's a mobile.
Yeah, it's big enough to have it has a bathroom and the bunk beds and the couch and a stove to cook on.
And so somebody drops this off on the frozen lake when it freezes.
You drag them out on skids, yeah. I mean, ice fishing shacks aren't new. They've been around for, like, when I was a kid, they were already all over the place, some places, but where I was, because of the nature of the fishing we were doing, they weren't big. Because if you wanted to bring an ice fishing shack, you would have to be able to drag it behind your snow machine, because you couldn't really drive trucks out. So there'd be a lot of like 8x4s and stuff like that that'll fit on the snow. And there's still a pain to get out there, because now you're trying to drag a shack down a fucking snow machine trail for an hour, you know, an hour and a half.
Oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can already picture it. And we're not talking about just a straight trail. It's like all over the place. So trying to keep that thing upright. So we never really did shacks. They were pretty few and far between. The tents weren't a thing yet when I was a kid. So it was mostly just ice fishing. I mean, we didn't even really have a lot of tip-ups back then. And they didn't have the little mini rods yet. So we'd just break sticks off, drill a hole in the ice, pile up the slushy snow beside, stick the stick in it, and tie the fishing line right to the end of that.
Yeah.
And go down. But nowadays, I mean, you look at, because here Alberta's not a huge ice fishing scene, but you look at some of these places where they got, like back home, when it freezes, it freezes. You know, I bet you there's 3 feet of ice back home.
Yeah, and it doesn't really melt. Like it doesn't, there was a melting period.
If there was a bigger population by my hometown, there would guaranteed be a business like they have down in Southern Ontario, where dude, they're taking these things out in two pieces. So you go out there and it's literally like a small little one bedroom apartment or something. You know, like you see the videos on thing, it's got a floor, you could be there in your socks, then there's just holes in the floor that you fish through. So this guy's got a good gig going. He just started building them and renting them out and doing that. And with the money he makes more. I mean, I've been humming and hawing about buying a tent. And now I'm like, after being in the shack, I'm like, fuck that, man. We'll just build a shack, because there's like me and a couple of my buddies, we're all going to buy tents. We're going to end up spending, you know, $800 each or $1,000 each to get these tents.
Can you build a modular shack, like just with the walls, where you kind of just put it up?
Nah, I don't want to. I mean, because the other thing about Alberta,
you put it on the truck, on a trailer.
I only ice fish a couple lakes anyway, so I could get that down to one lake really if I had a shack. I don't really need to. I mean, you could drag it around. I'm just gonna build. We're gonna build one on a skid. We figure for $1,000 each, we can build like a 20-foot by 8-foot or something like that, that we just share. And now,
what do you mean on a skid? How are you going to get it on the lake?
Well, you just have it on a skid, you know, like skids that they pull on and off of trucks. So probably I'll just make the skids out of like 6x4s, basically just put the shack on 3 skates. That'll either be like 3 2x6s bolted together that run the whole length of it, or like a 4x6. And then maybe put some Teflon on the bottom of that. But you just drag it. So basically what you do is...
You worry about weight at all, though? I mean, no matter how thick, I mean, how...
Nah, you're never going to make a shack that weighs as much as my truck. My truck weighs 7,000 pounds.
And that's fine on the edge of these lakes, because you're not out in the middle of the lake anyways. You're just where the ice is thick.
It's just about how thick...
Can you leave it there? Are you going to leave it there all year then, or like...
Depends if there's snow. If there's snow, you can kind of leave it there. If it's bare ice, it could melt in. But it's so easy to drag these things on the lake that, you know, you barely even notice it. We were watching guys drag them out, and when they hit the glare ice, the shack will pass the truck. So basically what you'd do is you'd store it in a storage yard where people store RVs and stuff like that. And then come the fall, you'd pay a tow truck $250 to tow it out there. And then that's on the pasture land. So I could just, I mean, they'd get pissed if you left it there all summer.
Yeah.
But what, I mean, there's 40 shacks on the shore there all winter. They don't, you know, it's quasi public land.
So you just leave your shack there. You get it towed there in the fall, you leave it there in the winter, and then you just drag it on and off when you use it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then basically then 3 or 4 of us can chip in on it, because it's, hey, the shack's there. You got a key, take it if you need it.
What are you going to make it out of?
And if you're out in the shack, then we just go meet you, you know?
What are you going to make it out of?
2x4s. I'm going to 2x4s and plywood. I think the sea cans are a bit heavy.
Yeah. Wow, that'll be fun, man. I mean, that's great. I think all the guys out here, like some of the guys I was listening, in hockey, they're talking about this stuff all the time, and people are out fishing, and there was that weird melty time here too, so... It wasn't like it usually is out here in winter.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of settled in the summer. I can run around and fish wherever I want in my boat. And in the winter, for the amount, you know, I feel like I'll do more fishing if I have a shack at one lake than I will if I had a tent and I could go to any lake. You know, it'd be nice to just be settled in someplace. There's a shack. There it is. Because it does make it a way
better experience.
Better experience. It's just, I mean, I don't really care, because I grew up just being out there freezing your ass off and fishing. But to get the kids out and stuff like that, you got a little shack to go warm up in. Now you can stay out more than a few, because we never went more than 3 or 4 hours either, you know? So now you can go out all day, have dinner, stay overnight if you want.
Yeah.
It's almost like winter camping. I mean, that's a, you know, the fishing is just something you're doing while you're out there hanging out. That,
yeah, exactly.
Makes it a little funner.
Yeah.
So we're going to do that this summer. Me, Justy, and Sean build a shack and park it at Newell. I mean, you can always still go fish someplace else if the weather's good, but I just feel like if I have a shack, I'll use it more.
Yeah. So have you ever been to a pro lacrosse game?
I have. I've been to several. Yeah, I got pretty good a while ago. Yeah,
really?
When I was going to... Because what would happen is I think I originally got into it because the Flames were on one of their playoff runs. So you're so jacked about sports, but we couldn't get tickets for the Flames. So we ended up just buying tickets for the Roughnecks.
For the Calgary Roughnecks, okay.
And then we went to a game and it was a good time. I mean, it's a party.
Yeah.
It's a
Yeah.
I was still partying then. So it was literally a party. You know, it's way more of a party than a hockey game. Everyone's there. It was a Saturday night. The music keeps playing the whole time.
Yeah, isn't that weird? Eh? The music's playing during the play. Like, that was the one thing I noticed. I was like, oh, that's what it is. The music doesn't shut off.
Yeah. So
it was pretty loud. And it was super, like, super colorful and bright and mad. But those guys were talented. It was, like, really, really good level, like, good play, good lacrosse. And so it's the Saskatchewan Rush. And they're first in the league. So it was also that sense of, like, okay, you've, you know, you're, it's not just like the bottom of the league sort of playing it out. Like, these guys are super, they're pros, right? They're like leading the league.
That's a national sport.
Yeah, pretty much, besides hockey. Yeah. I mean, I used to play it as a kid, but I just didn't realize that there was such a league going on in our little town, you know, in Saskatoon. So
that's technically the national sport.
Yeah.
Is lacrosse. I see you bought a jersey.
No, I was just a friend that we went with.
You borrowed one?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
lacrosse.
I'm not sure I'll put the thing on.
It's a good time, for sure. I'm going ice fishing, I think, Sunday, just out, you know, not in a shack, just out with Sean to try and catch some fish, have a time. I mean, we only got the season's over, I think, March 15th.
Yeah, it's less than 2 months, yeah.
It goes by fast. And then wait for the geese to get here for spring goose season. Well, that'll be time. I mean, we should talk about, we do need people to support the show. Grandamerica.ca/support. If you appreciate what we do over here and you want to check it out, you want to support it, you want it to keep happening, you want us to keep doing shows, you want us to get to 1,000 episodes, head over to grandamerica.ca/support today. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation, and we'll read your note. We'll make you a noble instead of a pleb as well. We do have a few people to thank. We had Nicole Friesen signed up for the $1.50 a month. She went over and above the $1 a month we asked for.
Oh, thanks, Nicole.
With the $1.50, yeah. And then we also, that's the same one, isn't it? And then we also had a donation from, did we do Dwight Eichhorn last week?
No, I don't think so.
$30 from Dwight Eichhorn. So we appreciate that. Thank you, buddy. And I believe that's it. So we do need some more people to support the show. 2 is not a good showing. It'd be nice to be 20 a week, you know? When we get to 20 a week, let's get to 5 first. America.ca/support. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation today if you are getting a little value from our podcast. Send some value back our way. Now that we're through winter, Christmas now, you know, time to sport.
Yeah.
Time to sport. We got some great trips coming up. A couple of months till our Easter Island trip. 4 spots left on that. If people want to come, it's a great crew. Going to be a good time. We have the Serpent Mound Solstice Festival thing. If people want to get in on that, there's just some camping spots left and a few shared accommodation options. There's the New York Finger Lakes Flood Tour, August 30th till September 5th. And that's it for next year so far. And then we're also doing the Malta, Sicily, Sardinia trip in the spring after that. I was talking to Randall yesterday, though, about maybe he's going to call me next week when he's done his, going through his crap with Buddy over there. And, you know, his arch enemy.
Yeah.
And then he's going to talk about maybe helping him set up some more classroom style stuff close to home where it's just lectures and we don't really go anywhere. Just hang out, have lunch, have dinner, and listen around to lecture us for a while.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, not as quite as tiring on him, you know, trying to drag him here and there. But we are taking him out for that Finger Lakes tour in the fall if people want to check that out.
I mean, the thing is, he's got so many presentations to do. Like, he can present on so much esoteric symbolism, cathedrals, you know, climate change, the cataclysms, sacred geometry. I mean, he's just got, so yeah, it'd be good to do some more in person.
Yeah, and split it up into some clear subjects, you know, so you know exactly what you're getting and what's going to be covered when you get there. So be a good time.
Yeah.
People check that out, contact@thecabin.com. come on a trip with us. It's going to be fun before the end of the world or whatever's going to happen. You know, seems it's hard to know which way it's going. Could get better, could get worse.
We talk about some of that crazy stuff on our other show, Grimerica Outlawed.
Yeah, y'all might enjoy the round. If you like the intros, you'll probably like the roundup. So it's a good one. Anyway, do you have a bio for Jack?
Yeah. Jack is, he's been a global innovator and he's into technology and stuff, an engineer. So he comes from that, you know, science-y engineering background. And I'm just going to read the mission from his website, which is jrbielik.com. But also the better way to get there is probably lostintime.world will take you there as well. To illuminate our past cycles of knowledge loss, inspiring humanity to consciously preserve, protect, and pass on our collective wisdom for all future generations. So a great idea for a topic and a book. And we're looking forward to talking to him when he gets his next book out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Big thanks to Jack for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Like I say, please support the show. If you are in a situation to even give us a dollar a month, we're trying to get just like 1,000 of you to sign up for a dollar a month. Let's start there. America.ca/support. But for now, just enjoy the chat with Jack Bielik.
We are excited to have Jack Bielik with us. He's got a book out called Lost in Time. We can't wait to talk about this, right up our alley. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, Graham and Darren.
Yeah, this will be really, really fun. We talk about this ancient mystery stuff all the time. And to me, there's some really big technological mysteries. I don't know if you'll address those specifically, but we can talk about lots of little examples that kind of get left out, you know, so this will be good.
Yeah, there are so many examples. You know, it took me 10 years to put this book together. So I really compiled a lot of facts. I think there's over 300 facts in the book.
Well, that's kind of what I was going to ask you before we get into some of the fascinating details of it. It's like, why did you decide to put a book together like this? And what, like, were you always interested in sort of ancient mysteries? Or did something happen that kind of tweaked your interest specifically?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because my background is in technology. I've done a lot of technology work. I've got an engineering background. And I just started seeing these things in the news, you know, different facts would pop up. I watched the History Channel, whatever. And I would see things. And I go, wow, you know, that's fascinating. I never knew that, you know, and just put them together. And I wrote the book, I started writing the book and putting all these facts together. And then I kind of got to the point where I said, well, what is the point? What is the point to all this knowledge we've lost, forgotten, and destroyed? And by the way, how can you write a book about something that's been lost, forgotten, and destroyed? But that's the point. That's what this book is. And I don't think there's anything like it anywhere.
Well, and there's a really big point that I think that we can talk about, but it's that we're not, this wasn't like a linear, we don't progress linearly as humans, right? Maybe there was times where we were smarter or at least in a different way than we were. And I think that's the main difference between our paradigm today is that we're just, you know, everything in our past was supposed to be dumber and not as smart, not as advanced, you know, kind of like the hunter-gatherer type thing, which when we look at some of these leftover stone walls, this Cyclopean architecture. It's like, this wasn't hunter and gatherers that did this stuff.
Yeah. You know, when you start looking back on it, you find out they were just as smart as we were, but in a different way, you know, and they had a different paradigm. I think they used for their life. It wasn't like we do, like we think about things and atoms and molecules and that sort of thing. They thought about things differently, but they had the exact same needs that we have.
Was there anything specifically that triggered you into like, okay, like I got to write this all down. Like, was there a couple things you're like, somebody else needs to know about this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, the one that hit me right off was the cataract surgery. You know, I was doing a little bit of reading and it was just on the side and I saw, oh, 800 BC, this famous physician, his name is Shushruta, he did cataract surgery in 800 BC. I'm like, what the heck? You know, we started doing cataract surgery in the 1700s. And you can see that I have some pictures in the book about how they would have to tie a person down to a chair to do cataract surgery. And that's because your eyes have more nerve endings. Your cornea of your eye has more nerve endings per square inch than any other part of your body. And you know, when you get a hair in your eye or you get a piece of dust, it drives you nuts until you get it out, you know? So when they started doing cataract surgery in the 1700s, they would have to keep the person down until they invented cocaine eye drops that, you know, were an anesthetic. But 800 BC, Shushruta did cataract surgery. He did a whole slew of other things. We have books and writings of his. They did nose jobs, you know, rhinoplasty. He treated diabetes. Just amazing the things that he did. But if we just keep looking further back, we can find the Ebers papyrus that was found in ancient Egypt, 2400 BC. You know, what is that, 4,000 years ago, they were doing cataract surgery then.
Were they using any sort of, like, were they tying people to chairs or did they, I mean, because in a lot of times you look back at these other cultures and they had at least a less barbaric way than we started out doing it. You know, like nowadays stuff's pretty fancy. You don't even really know you got this surgery half the times, but like you say, for a couple hundred years, we were sort of barbaric about it. And it seems like some of these ancient cultures, you know, they like the cocaine drops is a good idea. That's something that isn't sort of, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that other cultures were using throughout history for different things. I mean, that's kind of how we found cocaine, right? Because they were using it to climb mountains or something.
Yeah, I'm not totally clear on the history of it, but you know, they had ways of numbing. They probably used cocaine, but just gave it to the person, you know, so they wouldn't feel pain. But I mean, we even do that today. What do we use? Methadone in hospitals when people are in great pain to you know, numb them. And they probably used the same types of things. But they show, the pictures show them doing the surgery and they're not, you know, in great pain. So they must have had a way. And their surgery was slightly different than how we do it. They used what's called a couching procedure, where they would push the lens out of the way using a little needle-like device. I think it was made out of bronze. And so it was a different technique. But and it wasn't that effective. It was only about 40% effective, I think. You'd end up blind anyways. So
are you talking about the Egyptian one or the 1700s?
No, the ancient ones. The one in 800 BC. They said it was only about 40% effective.
So what would they do? They'd move the lens out of the way and then what, scrape the eye and then put it back?
They would just move the lens out of the eye. So now it would be clear. You know, you wouldn't have the cloudy lens anymore in front of your eye.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a little different, but you know, they had the same needs. I like to talk about plumbing because, you know, plumbing, you need plumbing, you know, sewer systems, you know, they started back in, you know, we think about it back. The Romans used sewer systems. They had water distribution systems in 500 BC. And, you know, we even find it further back. The Babylonians in 2900 BC had sewers, and Neolithic people living in 3000 BC in Scotland and the Orkney Islands had sewer systems. Yet, if we fast forward to the Middle Ages in Europe, the 1300s, there were no sewers. There were no toilets. Sewage ran off the top of buildings and into streets. And it wasn't until the toilet was invented in the 1500s in England for use in castles that they came back. So, you know,
do you think that's what I was just going to ask that? Do you think that's like a forgotten where, because there's all these sort of signs in our history that point to a prehistory, you know, for lack of a better term, like it seems like the people we're talking about in Scotland, even in 3000 BC, I would argue didn't have the capacity to be building some of the things that we're finding in some of the places around the world or buried and things like that. So you can almost look at that as like a forgetting, you know, we slowly forgot about all this stuff and it's sort of rudimentary because you'd be sort of listening to stories after stories after stories about how the, you know, you never used to have to go to the outhouse. You could just go to this room and it's so you'd be sort of trying to mimic that in different rudimentary ways. And it just sort of seems like, in some ways, it seems like our amnesia sort of peaked around like 1000 BC or somewhere in there.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. I used to think, oh, you know what? We forgot all this because, you know, we destroyed the knowledge because of wars, or there's earthquakes, there were fires, there were floods. We lost all the information, right, because of that. But I don't think that's it. I think the real reason we keep losing this information is because we don't want to save it. You know, if we wanted to save it, we would save it. You think about yourself. If you wanted to save something for a friend or a family member, you put it somewhere where it's safe, you know. You make sure, you know, you put it in a fireproof container in your house or something, so it's there for the future. But here's the problem. As a culture, as a world culture, as, you know, different cultures, we don't think that's important. You know, we would rather go to Baghdad and bomb, you know, Iraq and lose millions of artifacts during the Baghdad War. And it wasn't just one country, right? It was many people going in there, you know, they were participating in that. And not only that, their own people were doing it as well. But, you know, just destroying, they estimate over a million artifacts.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And it's because we don't care. If we cared, we wouldn't do it.
True. But it seems like there's some evidence they did care about a couple of artifacts, because there's a bunch of reports that a lot of those special units went straight to museums and sort of took over the place.
Yeah.
It almost seemed like they were looking for something specific.
Yeah.
The interesting thing that lines up with it, because you have the Y chromosome bottleneck, where it's like 95% of all the male genes sort of combine, and that's right in that 5,000 to 7,000 year ago window. You know, they say wars or this and that. We've had other people on that think it was maybe to survive a cataclysm. That's what you would do, is you'd have, you know, you'd have one dude for every 20 women if you had like a space issue or something like that, because that's the easiest way to sort of rebuild the population after collapse. But either way, whether it's a war or what it is, it seems like 19 out of every 20 dudes died around 5,000 to 3,000 BC, which is sort of right in that window where we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Something seems to have happened. Well, there's the big elephant in the room, the Great Pyramid at Giza, you know, and I've done something. So, you know, there's a lot of conjecture over how those pyramids were built, you know, and we have a lot of, there's a lot of good ideas on it, but we don't have the anything written, anything that says how they did it. And it would be a huge manufacturing, it would be a huge engineering feat today. You think about it. So I did some simple math, just really simple. I said, well, one of those pyramids has 2.3 million stones, right? And we estimate that it took them 20 years to build it. So if you just do some simple math, that means you would have to lay 1 3-7-ton stone every 2 minutes, 12 hours a day, 365 days a year for 20 years. And by the way, they all have to be precisely flat. They all have to fit exactly together. You know, you just can't haphazardly throw these things on top of one another. You know, that is amazing.
Well, which also means you didn't have to just lay it, but you had to quarry it and finish the stone as well.
Move it.
We've seen the casing stones on the small pyramid. We've climbed up to the top of the back of it, and it is completely flat. Like the ones that are exposed, they have this like the bubbly, you know, the pillowy surface on the outside. But then there's this whole area of the top of the stone where the other casing stone fit on top, and it's completely flat.
And it's centered on all four sides. So it's almost like that was their sort of, they had to flatten out one spot in the beginning, and that was their working point. And you can see that they're just clearly laying on these blocks that are sticking out a foot and a half past this flat surface. And you go to other sites where there's clear evidence that they were just doing that and then scraping it off after, you know, how they were doing that. You know, we were lucky enough to go to Egypt to get special permission to spend time in the pyramid with just our group and really, you know, with no cameras and no security, and go to all the other places. And you walk away from that saying there's no fucking way that this conventional story is true. There's just no way. We can go there and you can see that they've built this, say, the Temple of Dendera. I might mix them up, but I think it's the Temple of Dendera, which is nice. It's got the beautiful ceiling, all this sort of stuff, just covered in hieroglyphics everywhere you look. The wall, the ceiling, the columns. And then buried underneath that out back, you have the Assyrian that has blocks that are 10 times the size, workmanship that's 10 times as good, and there's not a single hieroglyph on any of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's mind-blowing. So, I think that's evidence. We had some technique, you know, that has been lost. You know,
And it was global, because to me, the real, like, smoke is the, like, you look at those nubs, and you see them in Egypt on the blocks, you see them in Machu Picchu on the blocks, you see them in Easter Island on the blocks. It seems like wherever we go, we were looking at Japan, they got the nubs. We're going to Malta next year. We haven't been there yet, but we've seen pictures of them, and they've got the same nubs. So it just seems like we don't even know what the nubs are for, but somebody did, clearly, and it seemed to be people all over the world knew what they were for.
I have a theory.
All right.
It's the last remnants of the excavation that just holds the block in place before they take the block out of the quarry. Like, because when we see the obelisk being quarried out and the big Easter Island head that's in the middle of the rock still, like, there's a minimum clearance that whatever tool they were using, it seems to be like, I think 18 inches or 2 feet. Whatever they were using, it seems like they needed that much space. So all on the Aswan quarry, you see a whole bunch of those scoop marks and stuff going all the way down. There's always at least that much space. So my point is, actually, in the Aswan quarry, that one, you know, that one, not the obelisk Darren, but the other big block that was left there, they've gone down and almost like the bottom is very narrow. So you're going to have to get to a point where the block's just sort of sitting on a couple nubs. That's my theory is that
break it off.
And then they break it off. The nubs is just what's left before you actually like extract the block.
But, yeah.
Who knows?
well, and your point is very good too, because I'm saying you got to lay one stone every 2 minutes, you know, right, for 20 years every.
Yeah.
Well, you got to cut one stone.
Dress every it.
2 minutes for 20 years. I mean, you
know. And that's the easy part.
And move it.
Yeah, and that's still the easy part. And query it, and move it, and do all that stuff, elevate it. That's still the easy part compared to when you start looking at what they've done with the shafts and the chambers inside there with blocks that weigh 80 or 100 tons. Yeah. That's where the, like, could we actually build this thing today if we tried? You know, because I go back and forth on it. I really do, where it's like, because I did construction, you know, on a pretty high level for a long time. And I've lifted beams that weigh, you know, 20,000, 30,000 pounds. And I've seen the cranes that we need just to build that. So to think about that, at a 30,000 pound beam that needs the biggest crane in town, that's still only 15 tons. You know, that's nothing. We're talking about moving blocks 10 times that and getting them 100 feet or 200 feet in the air. It just seems like, I don't know if we could do it. It'd be fine if we weren't such a fucked up people that we could be like, hey, let's try and build a pyramid. You know, it'd be like, costs like nothing compared to some of these wars, and it'd be a neat little experiment. I'm not sure we could do it.
Yeah, well, and I think that those numbers are that I gave are conservative, because when you're actually in doing construction, you know, you can't just figure out to do that. You got to worry about waste. You got to worry about, you know, every once in a while something's broken, so you got to do an extra one. Or, you know, when it's delivered, you know, something's wrong with it, so you got to have backups or, you know, surplus.
Weather, you have weather too, right? You're going to lose some days for weather. You're going to lose some days for, you know, church.
Mental and health days. Mental health days and sick days.
Somebody gets sick or injured, or you drop a stone on somebody's foot. I mean, who knows? I mean, all kinds of stuff, right?
And then you got the little stuff just like this, where it's like, you know, how did they make a granite vase that is perfect? You know, this is obviously just a chunk of one, but you start looking at stuff like that and you can see the tool marks on it. And they're like perfectly straight lines that go around this. Mine's just a shard. It's hard to find full pieces and they're worth a fortune when you do. But, you know, I can look at this thing and say there's no way that was done with the chisel and the hammer. So there's even like, it's not even just the pyramids. It's even just down to the small stuff they were doing that we don't even know if we could, make one of those granite vases today. They just, a few friends of ours just did some scans on some of them over at the Petrie Museum or whatever it was over, whatever it's called over in the UK. And they were finding that the thickness of that full piece is like within a thousandth of an inch, the entire artifact.
did you come across any granite working tooling at all in your research?
No, but I do have, there are some interesting things, such as, you know, this family in Lahore, India, made these solid, metal globes, and they were, you know, globes that they were used for to show pictures of the stars and the constellations and that sort of thing. They've had these globes for a long time, for thousands of years. But the interesting thing about these globes, and they're studied, you can find these, in, I think they have them at the Smithsonian. The interesting thing is these solid metal globes are hollow, and we don't know how they made them. Like, and this was in the 1400s, so it wasn't that long ago. But we have no idea how they made them. And if we tried to make one today, it would be very, very difficult. Because what we do today is we take two halves, we put them together, we weld it, and then we, you know, sand it down or whatever. But what they did is made a whole, you know, you can't use lost wax technique, you know, because the wax would melt. I mean, how do you do that with metal? Very difficult. But
it's not cast, right? They didn't cast it.
No. So, you know, it's an interesting thing that we find. And we find things all the time. I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about one of these.
Oh, I was going to ask you that. I had a note to ask you about the dodecahedron. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, you can get these. This is just a replica. You can get it on, I don't know, Etsy or one of those places. But yeah, the ancient Roman dodecahedrons, you know, these, they found over 100 of these. They were like in the year 300, I think, that these were buried. And they're dodecahedrons, so they have 12 sides. there's six on the top and six on the bottom, and each of the sides has a hole that's a different size. You can kind of see that. Each one, there's a big hole there, and that's
it's like a gauge then, maybe.
It's a smaller one. And there's all kinds of conjecture. Well, first of all, these are made out of bronze primarily. How'd they make these? I mean, they're you know, they have these little knobs on the end, you know, it's kind of be difficult to manufacture something like this, you know, it'd be a trick. But the problem is we don't know what they're for. I mean,
I got an idea.
What's that?
I got an idea what that's for.
The gauge.
Now, when I look at that, I think of it as like a bracket for scaffolding, because you could just have a bunch of bamboo or whatever you're using and slide it into those holes and brace it and add verticals. And then you would use those little nubs coming off to tie it off to or to clamp it off to. That looks very similar to like a tube and clamp bracket on tube and clamp scaffolding.
Except the holes would be standardized in all one size for whatever you're using.
Maybe, unless you have different things. Like that might have to orientate a certain way, where one way is for your vertical pulls, one way is for bracing, and one way is for
maybe. Are the opposite holes the same size as the?
No.
No way. They're
all different. Yeah.
Wow. So that's fascinating. And the other weird esoteric part about the dodecahedron is how important that was from a platonic solid. Like the ancients used to think that was the main shape in our reality. Like our universe is made up of the dodecahedron, like those kind of like big kind of myths about it.
Yeah. So there's a lot of conjecture. Well, the problem is we have nothing in writing. We have no pictures of them. We have no written record of anybody ever making them or using them or anything. So everything from spiritual purposes to using them for knitting, you know, it's unknown.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great example. I mean, that's a really good example. I was thinking maybe the nubs were to protect the, you know, the flat surface. If those surfaces around the holes are flat, like you don't want it to be banged. And, but I mean, even then, why would you need those surfaces to be super flat either? That's that's crazy. Are they a bunch of different sizes as well? They're like the overall sizes.
Yeah.
And that's just Rome. You know, that's not even that long ago. That's the stuff that was supposed to just be like leading right up to us.
Yeah. Yeah. 300. You know, it's not super old, it's not like, you know, but we forgot, you know, just like we forgot how they made those globes, or, you know, we forget so much.
Was there any kind of like, did this change your view of the ancients? Like, how do you, what's your overall sort of view of the ancients after going through this and writing the book? Like, do you have a, you know, a change in how you view humanity?
Well, the biggest change, I mean, there were a lot of surprises, you know, Qin Shi, the first emperor of China, who built the terracotta army, the mausoleum in China, amazing man. He had all kinds of technology. You know, they're afraid to open his mausoleum because it's said to be booby trapped. With rivers of mercury. So,
I was going to say mercury for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. They did amazing things back in their time. They made swords out of that had chromium in them, so they didn't rust. They were still sharp when they found them. You know, if you find a sword today that was buried in the Middle Ages, you know, with the knights and all that, you know, those swords are all rusted, and you know, you can barely even tell they're a sword. But they knew how to use chromium back then, and there's all kinds of examples of that. Wood's steel you know, different kinds of swords that we can't manufacture today. But you know, found all kinds of interesting facts like that. But here's really the crux of the discussion on this book, is that, you know, this is cool. We keep doing it over and over again. Can we do that today? I mean, could we lose our knowledge today? Now, no one's running around thinking about that. I mean, you don't think about losing your information. I'm going to tell you, I went out the other day. I wanted a picture off of a USB drive that I had, and I didn't remember which USB drive it was. I had eight of them. And they were, I don't know, 8 years old or so. They were older USB drives. So I started looking through these USB drives, and out of the eight USB drives.
Oh, no, I don't want to hear this. Yeah, don't tell me this.
Only six worked. The other two couldn't get anything off of them. They didn't even light up the machine.
Because they're just not formatted the same back then? Or
no, they're just dead. I mean, think about your computer. How long is your computer going to work for? You know, five?
Well, years? I have a really good example, because that's great, because everything's digitized now, right? And we think, oh, it's good right now. But I mean, how long is that going to last? So I have a bunch. I found my old 8mm tapes. I used to have a Handycam, a Sony Handycam from 89. And I found all my tapes from Egypt. Like, I was on when you could climb the pyramid. Like, I'm wondering, what do I have for footage from Egypt and all, right? I want to see it from 35 years ago or whatever. And I went to look through the process of digitizing those. And I was like, I'm just going to hook that up to the old TV because I have the wires and stuff. And you can't even do it. You can't. You have to convert it from analog through a VCR that can do that.
Yeah.
Into a recording device in your computer, or you have to, or how you can go through your TV, and then hopefully it's going to work on channel three if you go through the proper VCR. And I mean, it's like very, very, I thought maybe there was like one stage of like, oh yeah, okay, just, but yeah, it's almost impossible to digitize stuff from 35 years ago.
Yeah. You know, I interviewed the head curator for the Internet Museum or the Computer Museum, in San Francisco. And he was telling me that they have all these old original IBM PCs and XTs and all these original computers. And they use floppy drives. You remember floppy drives, and they put those in there. And that media, becomes brittle and cracks and falls apart, and you can't use it anymore a lot of times. And so what they had to do was take the computer programs and print them on paper because the media is bad. So
we're going back to paper now.
Back to paper. We're going backwards.
And soon we'll be scribing it on stone so that it really lasts, because paper will burn or whatever. So now you wonder, like, see, that is I've never thought about it that way. I mean, maybe some of these important things were put on stone, and maybe they had other ways to do it, but we just think, oh no, all they could do was chisel, hieroglyphs on stone or like symbols on stone. They didn't have any other communication, but maybe they did.
Oh yeah. I assume they had that we've got like a 1%, because all the other stuff was just like books and binders. That's gone now.
Yeah. Well, only 1.6% of humanity has been recorded. So it's assured that there is knowledge out there that we don't have. And be interesting, I'm sure. It might be difficult. You think about it, if somebody in 500 years were to find an old cell phone, buried in the dirt.
Or a compact disc.
Yeah. But I mean, you don't have a device to read it. How could you open it? How could you turn it on? I mean, even if you found a piece of paper, I mean, would language change? It's bound to change. It's changed over the years. The von Neuich manuscript. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah.
They've had scholars and linguists and all kinds of technology. They've tried to figure out what's in that manuscript. That's stored at the Yale Museum library. They have a copy of it there. You can see it online. It's pretty cool. Very different sort of writing. But they've been able to verify, scholars have verified that it's a real language, like it's not made up. And the reason they can do that is they have a way, there's a law that all languages that are spoken or written have to follow. And that manuscript the text in there follows that law. It's called Zipf's law. And, you know, they know the frequency of letters and words and that sort of thing. And so they know that it's an actual language. But we don't know what it is. We can't read it. They've tried to use AI on it, you know.
That's what I was just going to ask you is how old is that manuscript? But also, is AI becoming a tool that might be used to decode some of these ancient scriptures and stuff?
Yeah. Well, they don't know. I mean, that manuscript was, I mean, they can trace it back to 1400, I think. Now, could it be older? I mean, possibly. I don't know. But at least back to 1400. Now, you know, the scholars were talking. I was on a webinar and these scholars were talking about that manuscript and how AI has been ineffective. It can't do it because the basis of knowledge that AI uses is the same knowledge we have. I mean,
yeah.
It goes out and scrapes the internet for information or we give it data, you know, and that's how it knows.
Yeah, you know, it's still like a version or two away from being able to make its own analysis, I guess, because you'd think because people would be, you know, people have been able to decode some of this stuff. I guess the Rosetta Stone helped with a lot of that. Maybe we could just find another one of them.
Well, Rob said, Rob in the chat says that manuscript was a trick on the king. It's a private cipher.
Could be, but they've had cryptologists working on it. I mean, all kinds of people, very, you know, smart people have tried to decode it.
How did you, I mean, maybe they did decode it and they just didn't tell us. That's the other concern you start to have in modern ages. Like, it seems like they know some of this stuff is not, you know, stuff that we took for granted maybe for a while that's clearly been overturned with evidence, but you still get some people that'll just defend it to the death. And that aside, what? How did you get into the book? Like, what was the thing that you came across, or the fact, or the artifact that sent you down this rabbit hole?
You know what? The very first thing that I saw that really sent me down here was a vending machine. So, Hero of Alexandria invented a vending machine in 10 BC. And Hero of Alexandria was a really, he was a big inventor, invented many things, but he invented a vending machine that you could put a Roman coin into and it would dispense holy water at temples. And it was even so sophisticated as to generate a
great gig. I mean, come on.
well, you know, so it would dispense holy water, and then they would generate steam and have it go on the face of an idol and make it look like it was crying in order to get more money, more donations. So things haven't changed so much in 2,000 years. But it is amazing, you know, how a simple thing like a vending machine, you know, is, and that's really what got me going, that one thing.
Have you come across any giant's weapons, any oversized swords or axes or stuff? I know I see all these memes online, and half of them I think are probably fake, but I've heard of some that are, you know, even from China, I think they've got some really big ones.
Yeah, I haven't. I am doing, you know, more and more research on some of these things. There's a lot of information, you know, like Archimedes' death ray that was used in 213 BC during the Roman siege of Syracuse. Syracuse held off the Romans from overtaking them for, I forget what the time was, like a year or so. It was a huge amount of time. And Archimedes was another one of these guys. Now, you know, how he did that, they conjecture, they don't know, but they conjecture that he used mirrors somehow from the sun to generate this ray that would, you know, catch the boats on fire, to keep the Romans away. And you know, they've tried to do it. There's several universities that have tried to do this. And, you know, if they had 50 people hold mirrors, they could start a piece of paper on fire. You know, it was, I don't think that's what Archimedes had. You know, he had something a little bit better. But, you know, there's a lot of examples of things like that. Even examples of where, even, you know, maybe there was atomic explosions in the past. In the, I believe it was the Indus Valley, where they've found glassified remnants of sand and artifacts there that they believe the only way that could have been done is from an atomic explosion or, you know, some very, very intense explosion. So I think, you know, Darren was talking about a little bit, you know, how some of this information gets hidden or becomes secret, maybe on purpose, you know, maybe it was a good thing. I don't know, depending on what that was. But, you know, I think people should be able to make their own decision on how to use it and what to use it for.
So did you have to have any sort of rules around what to include in your book? Because there's a bunch of myths as well. Like, let's say, like Greek fire or ever-burning lights, ever-burning lamps, and the Ark of the Covenant, the Vajra, these kind of like mythological weapons. Like, because some of these are physical items that are there, but they might have been used in a different way or with different sort of magical powers. So how did you, is there any way that you kind of had to distill a bunch of stuff out of your book?
Yeah, that's great, Graham, because yes, because there is so much written out there, you know, and a lot of it is well-placed, you know, there's no question, you know, people have made good, what do you want to say, you know, academic or not even academic, I mean, good reasons and rational thought, you know, as to why this or why that. But I tried to just stick to things that, you know, we have actual evidence of, you know, we could go over there and look at it or we could touch it, we could see it, you know, I tried to stick to that. And I might veer off a little bit in my next book. I might go more and look for more in other areas and see what we can find. So I'm working on the next book, which is going to be a collaboration, and I'm going to look at megaliths and monoliths, both above ground and below ground, around the world, and look at maybe trying to figure out what was the point, why are there all these all over the world? And, you know, maybe they're, you know, I'm thinking maybe it was for, you know, healing, maybe personal healing, maybe healing for the earth. You know, maybe we're kind of mean to the earth, I think. You know, maybe something like that. So, yeah, I'm going to be taking a look at it, and I might open up the doors a little bit on the next book.
Nice. When do you think that'll come out?
Probably would be next year. Yeah.
We got a couple of trips. I mean, we're going to Easter Island and we're going to Malta, Sicily, and Sardinia. So you're welcome to come along. There's a couple of available spots on both those.
Oh, great. Yeah. I think I'm going to Malta this year. I'm going in April, I think.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah. That'll be fascinating.
Yeah.
Sardinia is I never even knew there was stuff on Sardinia, but it's just sort of like there's more stuff than you can see in a week. Is what we found out. We had to figure out a bunch of stuff to cut out because it's just Sardinia just seems to be this gold mine of stuff right from megalithic through to Roman, through to medieval, right up till now. I mean, it's one of those rare places in the world where you can sort of see that.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. So is this a tour you're doing with your...
Yeah, we do tours. Yeah, we have contact at thecabin.com. We do a lot of stuff with Randall Carlson. And then we do some megalithic stuff on our own. Like we got Easter Island in April, Serpent Mound in June. We got a flood tour of the Finger Lakes with Randall Carlson in September. And then we got the Maltas not till the spring of 27. And now we're sort of poking. We're looking at adding Japan to the roster here.
Wow. Sounds great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's neat to see these things firsthand, for sure. It really, like, because you can look at the pictures and sort of take for granted some of the ways of, not take for granted, but you can really just sort of undervalue how well built that stuff is. And when you go there and you look at it, and you can get down on your hands and knees and look at a column base or something like that, and it's just like, you know, I'm not sure that that's, again, you look at stuff that it's like, I don't know, we could do that. I'm not sure. I mean, we've seen stuff on Elephant Island and in Karnak where it's not even the big stuff, like on the Great Pyramid. It's just like a solid one piece granite block that's like the size of a truck, and it's just perfect. You know, it's made out of one piece of solid granite, and it's perfect. And it's like one piece that's still intact in like a graveyard of a shards of the exact same sort of stuff. So it's not even like it was a feature piece. It was just like their stuff. It was just their stuff. And it seems like it was all, and you can even see a lesser version of that or a better version of that, depending on how you look at it. Like from a, I would argue from a, like a megalithic standpoint, the cathedrals are a drop away, but in a like an ornamental standpoint, they're sort of above and beyond. I mean, you look at those cathedrals and we're not doing anything like that even anymore. I mean, if you go walk through those cathedrals in Europe, and I've only been in a couple, there's just like everywhere you look what is like took someone forever to make, you know? So they had so much food and so much abundance and whatever going on that they took the time to make these cathedrals that just sort of, you can't even really put into words, but when you walk into one and then you walk into the mall or even these hotels that are supposed to be nice or whatever we've got today, and nothing really compares.
Yeah, I agree totally. I've been in some of those churches that were built in, I don't know, 1300 or whatever. And you're like, wow, you know, this is a work of art. It's not just, you know, it's a masterpiece. And what kind of workmanship went into this? It's just amazing.
Yeah. And you're going to love the Cyclopean architecture all over the world too. I mean, how is that all over the world? The same type of architecture. When I say Cyclopean, I mean that the real tight polygonal shape blocks, you know, fitting together exactly, almost like earthquake proof or disaster proof, or maybe polar reversal flood proof. Like it could be like, you know, that's, yeah, it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, those pyramids, you know, they were built in a way, even the other ones, there's Mayan pyramid, I've seen some of those, you know, they still stand through earthquakes and whatever else. They're still there.
Yeah.
Built phenomenally. Yeah.
So is there anything else in your first book, this book, that we should mention? Any other highlights in there that?
Well, the one thing I do want to touch on, because I did talk about the past a little bit, and then the present, you know, what we're doing today and how we store information on SSDs and, you know, even DVDs and CDs that only have 30 or 40 years of life, those pits in there will oxidize and you won't be able to read it and over time. So just about all the media we use, it has a short lifespan, less than 100 years.
Easily. Even analog tape too, I guess. That's yeah, probably pretty fragile too.
Yeah, it is. You know, they have a lot of trouble with a lot of the old films from, you know, The Wizard of Oz or whatever, you know, that they have to reconstruct, or sometimes they can't, you know, those films become destroyed just from age and, you know, whatever the elements. But, you know, today we tend to think, you know, as we're storing more and more information and denser means, you know, more and more in smaller places, you know, you really have to be thoughtful about where you're putting your stuff, where you're putting your information. You know, if it's something that you really need or you really want others to have, you got to put it, you know, be redundant,
put it on the cloud.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
I'm going to talk about that because, but I think multiple places is the best approach, or, you know, maybe even put it on paper, or if it's a picture you really need, you know, print it, you know, save it like that. But yeah, the cloud, let's talk about the cloud for a bit.
Well, actually, before we do that, like what are some things that people can do besides just backup hard drives? Like, is there some sort of drive that's going to be a little bit better that might not be obsolete as quick, or?
Well,
is all this technology just in, we're going to be in trouble in a few years?
It's all pretty much in trouble, except, you know, I will say, if you think about it a little bit, because most of it's just hardware, you know, it's just electronics. Electronics breaks, period. It just does. And so storing stuff on there, you know, has a limited life. You know, you think about a vinyl CD or a vinyl record, you know, how long is that good for? You know, we're still playing those today. I mean, they're good for a really long time. Although they can get destroyed too. But my point is just really think about what it is you're saving and make sure you're putting it on a media that's going to be good for whatever period of time you want to save it for. So it's just really being thoughtful about it, you know, and thinking about it. So yeah, redundancy is one choice. Putting it on media that lasts longer. There is a few companies that are working on some devices. There's a, I think it's called an M drive. That's supposed to last 1,000 years, but you're just going to need the hardware to read that drive. You know, that becomes a problem. You know, right now, try to find a drive to read even your CD. Most laptops don't even have CD drives in them anymore. You know, you got to go out and buy one special. So, you know, think about trying to read a floppy drive. You know, it's probably impossible. But, you know, you just have to think about the future. And that's really the point of the book. Think about the future. Think wide. Think about the people next to you. Think about your neighbors. Think long. Think into the future. And be a little humble. I mean, think about, well, hey, maybe I don't know exactly everything. You know, I don't know everything. So I could be open to new ideas. You know, what are other possibilities out there? You know, are some of these old things good? You know, could we use them in the future? Here's an example. In the year 400 BC in Peru, they started doing cranial surgery. And that is, you know, where you repair the skull from an injury, like, and if they got hit with an axe or, you know, fell down and cracked their skull or whatever, they got a hole in it. So they started doing cranial surgery. Well, in 400 BC, they were 40% successful in their surgery. And we'll fast forward to 1400, year 1400. They were still doing cranial surgery in Peru, but they were over 90% successful in their cranial surgery. Now, let's go up to the Civil War. In the Civil War, for cranial surgery, it was 50% successful. Now, if we could have kept that knowledge from Peru over to the Civil War, we could have saved people's lives and, you know, helped other people out. So, you know, this saving the knowledge is useful. You know, it's helpful to all of us, you know, and where we're going. We don't want to forget about the toilets again either.
Have you seen that book going around on the internet called How to Restart Civilization or whatever? And it's this big book, like a coffee table book that, you buy, and it says how to, like, it basically gives you all the stuff to restart civilization. But then when I started researching it, it's like kind of almost in a cartoony way. Like, it's not necessarily like a serious manual for restarting civilization, but it probably has enough information to help. So I didn't end up buying it, but I thought we need a book, like a survival book that's like, here's all the knowledge that we've learned on how to do stuff that, you know, you should know if you had to survive a cataclysm or whatever.
That's a great idea. You know, it's like when you have a baby and you come out of the hospital, they don't give you a book. You know, you just go home and figure it out. You know, And it's kind of, you're the same point, you know, a civilization, we need a book for civilization, a restart book. Say, hey, don't forget about these 12 things, you know, don't forget about toilets. Don't forget about whatever. Yeah.
How about the cloud?
Yeah. So, I'm going to make 2 points about it. So first of all, you know, we're not thinking about, you know, they have a lot of things in place. They just built right over here near where I live, a huge data center. It's a quarter mile by a quarter mile in size.
Holy, wow.
Gigantic. And guess what? They built another one a couple miles north. I think they like to put them in Arizona because we don't have many earthquakes or natural disasters. But the point is, you know, there are things that could happen that might affect those. And what if that happened? You know, in the 1850s, we had a Carrington event. And maybe, you know,
1859, yep.
Yep. And that Carrington event was a super solar storm. The Earth just happened to be, or the sun just happened to be pointed at the Earth when that happened. And it energized, well, we didn't have power lines back then. In the 1850s, we only had
telegraph, right?
Yeah, only telegraph. So it energized the telegraph wires and caused fires at the telegraph stations. What would happen if that one of those events happened today?
Oh, we'd be completely toast.
It would be a terrible situation. And now, would that destroy the data centers? I don't know. What would it do to the homes? Probably something. You know,
the cars, everything. I mean,
who knows?
If you wipe out electronics, we're toast in the West.
So that could be an event. I mean, you know, so what? Maybe the data centers might survive, but who's going to be able to read it? I mean, who's going to be able to access the data center? I mean, you know, it's just a big problem. So that's one idea. It's not just that. I mean, there are ways we could do it to ourselves. And I'll mention this to you. What happens if an atomic bomb is exploded in space?
An EMP.
It's the only thing. There's no air. There's no oxygen. There's not a fire. There's, you know, no other thing, just a huge electromagnetic pulse. And what's, you know, that going to do? Well, it's going to destroy a bunch of satellites. But besides that, it's probably going to send a big old pulse to the Earth. And what's that going to do? You know, so I think it's been done once and only once for probably good reasons. But, you know, if we have a nefarious bad actor, you know, could that happen? So there's ways.
Yeah, I like it. So what was I going to say then? So about the clouds, just be careful with the clouds, I guess. Be careful putting stuff that you want in the clouds. Try and like have redundancies and backups, print your pictures, all that stuff. I like that. That's interesting how you kind of wrap that in with the whole ancient, all the ancient stuff.
Yeah.
Have you always been into the ancient stuff, or is this like, because now you're getting into the megaliths? I mean, it sounds like you're tumbling down a rabbit hole from over here.
I know. I don't know. I don't think I'm going to be able to dig out of this one, but, but I, you know what? I always had a little bit of an interest in all this. You know, I always thought, you know, always was interested in the Mayans and the Egyptians. That always was a big thing for me to, I like to watch all those shows, you know, about Egypt and what they're finding and what they know. So I am very inquisitive that way. So yeah, I think that had a lot to do with writing the book and getting it out there.
Well, I'd love to know what you think about all the granite works that you find, that you come across, because to me that's one of the biggest physical mysteries that needs to be solved, that's just being ignored by all the archaeologists, is how they made the stuff that Darren talked about, like on the Elephantine Island, the big granite boxes in the Serapeum, the smoothing of the small pyramid casing stones that's still there, half finished. there's all these half finished granite works around that nobody's really explained, like how they did the quarrying. I mean, you know, it wasn't banging diorite balls onto the granite. Like, I just don't think the mainstream explanation. So, yeah. So there's a bunch of theories, but that's a big mystery that needs to be solved. So,
yeah, let's take it on. See what we come up with. Yeah.
Jack, this has been great. Is there anything we missed? Is there anything we need to touch on before we start to wrap up?
No, I think that was the point. I think just awareness is a catalyst for change. And I think just by everybody being aware of this, it'll help change you in some way that's for the better, you know, for the future.
Where can people get the book? Do you have a website or any social media or stuff like that they can follow you on?
Yeah, sure. Lostintime.world is my website, and you can go there. You can connect with me. I'm on everything. Let's see. Yeah, go there. My book's also available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I think I've been sold out on Amazon, so maybe Barnes & Noble's faster. I don't know.
Oh, good for you.
but so check it out. And bookstores can order it as well, your local bookstore.
Oh, good. Yeah. Let us know when the other one comes out too. We'll have you back on.
All right. Yeah. Great. This has been great.
Yeah. It's been fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Jack. Thanks for coming on the show. And when the book comes out, let us know. Like Graham said, we'll do this again. That'll be an interesting show because we've been tumbling down the rabbit hole for a little over a decade ourselves. So,
yeah. Yeah. You guys really know your stuff. Yeah.
We try to learn it anyway.
We don't really know anything. The more you learn, the less you feel like you know, you know.
that is the
paradox. Yeah. Thanks, buddy.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Jack. Come back anytime. Have a good day.
Take care.
And that was our chat with Jack Bielak.
Bielak.
Lost, we should have confirmed that. Lost in Time, a groundbreaking look at what humanity once knew. It's a good book. I haven't read it yet, but just the premise of it, you know,
I like it.
It's like a good entry level into some of the stuff. And this is a good book to buy, like, because most of the people that are listening to us are in the deep end of the pool already, but you all know some people that are still in the shallow end. This is a great entry level into we're not as smart as we think we are. So big thanks to Jack for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks for the 1% who keep us in business over at grimerica.ca/support. If you're getting some value from our podcast that we've given you 750 episodes of for free, check out grimerica.ca/support and sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation today. Of course, for all these people that watch on YouTube, you can just go to our YouTube page and sign up for like $2 or $5 a month there too. I think there's a couple different options there, so you can support through YouTube. And check out our other podcasts, grimericaoutlawed.ca, audiobooks at adultbrain.ca. And all those trips we were talking about, I think we got 4 for sale right now and some more coming soon. contact@thecabin.com. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
the fuel for your worries. But for God's sake, time is eternal. Please do not hurry. Please do not fret. Please act now in a way that doesn't lead to regret. So many cigarettes.